Welcome to the Red-Haired Archaeologist. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thank you for spending some time with me today, studying artifacts our ancient Near Eastern ancestors left behind, and considering if those just might change how we read, or sometimes read into, scripture. Off last week, the Northern Kingdom had just fallen into the hands of the kings of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Their king, Hosea, had been carried off into exile along with a lot of the Northern Kingdom's most prominent citizens. And while King Hosea was struggling against Shalmaneser V and against maybe Sargon II, down in the Southern Kingdom, a new king was anointed. His name was Hezekiah. He was 25 when he ascended to the throne, and he would rule in the Southern Kingdom for 29 years. From the very beginning of 2 Kings 18, we are told that Hezekiah was, quote, good in the Eternal's eyes, as was his ancestor David. His story begins with a summary of all of the good things that he really did religiously. It really wants to emphasize the reforms that he put into place in the Southern Kingdom. He destroyed any object that could have been worshipped, so the poles that had been erected to Asherah, altars for Baal, even a bronze serpent that had been made by Moses. Some people would go to that. They believed that it had healing powers, and so he even destroyed something that had been created by Moses and kept by the people for hundreds of years because it had become a distraction to the proper worship of God in the temple. He, because of all of these things that he did, it is hit home to us very quickly that he enjoyed God's favor. And it is after a description of all these things that the authors finally start to talk about his military endeavors. I think the order that everything is presented in here is really important, and the writers of Kings want the readers to know right off the bat that this is a man who has his priorities straight. The bulk of what we're going to read about his life is going to have to do with his military exploits, but I think it's important that his story starts off with the description of everything good that happened as far as worship under King Hezekiah. So to learn more about all the religious reforms that he made, we have to actually go into a different book of the Bible, 2 Chronicles. And Hezekiah's story is told there between the chapters of 29 and 31. There, we're told that the first act that he did was the restoration of the temple in Jerusalem. It had been closed by his father Ahaz, who is reported as being an idolatrous king, an evil king, a wicked king. And so Hezekiah opens it back up, and he instructs the Levites to get into the temple to cleanse it and to cleanse themselves so that they could do the work that needed to be done there. At this point, because in the Southern Kingdom, his father had closed off the temple, also because of what had been going on since the split with the Northern Kingdom, a lot of Levites went with the tribes of the north, went with them to hopefully help with worship practices and things like that. That was never going to go well because God could only be worshipped from the temple in Jerusalem, but some Levites over time did live in that area. Well, so with everything that was going on with the Neo-Assyrians and the Northern Empire, it is likely, and in fact, it is told to us that Jerusalem and the Southern Kingdom ended up accepting a lot of refugees, and many of those probably were Levites. And so he gets maybe the biggest group of Levites that has been down there in a really long time to come to polish everything up. And then he hosts an absolutely giant worship service with thousands of animals being slaughtered. And before doing this rededication of the temple, he sends out an invitation to all Israelites, not just the Southern Kingdom, not just in the north, but it says from Dan to Beersheba. And that's something we see periodically in the Old Testament. Whenever anyone is talking about the extent of the nation of Israel. It's often described as being from Dan in the north down to Beersheba in the south. Those are sort of the outer extremities of the nation. And so here you see Hezekiah not just doing this for his own people, but throwing the doors open wide and telling the people in the northern kingdom, hey, come down here, worship at the temple, do it in the right way for the first time in a really, really long time. And it seems like, based on the influx of immigration he got, that that is something that a lot of people took him up on. Well, so following the restoration of the temple and this giant party that he throws to honor the temple and to honor God and to commemorate Israel getting back, hopefully, into God's good graces, people return to their own homes. People go north, people go south, people go back to wherever they live. And when they go, Chronicles 31:1 tells us that they purged the nation of high places and altars. And so all these people went into Jerusalem. They were compelled to worship God properly in the future, and they took that feeling back home with them. And we actually see archaeological evidence of this. If you go to Beersheba, that southernmost city that is mentioned in, you know, in the description of Israel from Beersheba to Dan. You go there, and at Beersheba, there was a four-horned altar. It was discovered by archaeologists that the horns had been knocked off, it had been broken, and bits and pieces of it had been used later to build a wall. If you get to go visit Beersheba, it's a fabulous site. A lot of it has been excavated. What is really impressive about it, probably more than anything, is the water system that is there, the big cistern that is there. But also when you walk up, just adjacent to the visitor center, they actually have a replica of this four-horned altar that was found there. The altar itself, the actual artifact that came out of the ground, it is on display at the Israel Museum now, and it has been restored so that people can actually see what it looked like. But it's obvious that some illegal worship was going on at Beersheba at the time. And it appears, based on the way this was found, that indeed, in agreement with what Chronicles described, the people went back to their homes and they ended that. They got rid of the high place that was at Beersheba. Similarly, there's another city called Arad. We, of course, call it Tel Arad today because it is a tell, but the city of Arad is south of Jerusalem. It's due east of Beersheba, a lot closer to the Dead Sea. It's properly in the Negev. And what's interesting about this site is they had a fully formed, not even just a high place, but an actual temple with the Holy of Holies that it appears was actually in use at the same time the temple in Jerusalem would have been in use. This, of course, would have been illegal and was a huge problem. But also there is evidence that not so much that it was destroyed, but that it simply fell into disuse. So that was at Arad. It appears that the illegal worship practices stopped there. And then also, if you stay in that southern strip, we go to a place called Lachish. I mentioned it last week. It's one of my favorite sites. We're going to talk about it more next week too. But at Tel Lachish, when they were excavating the big city gate there, they actually found that in one of the chambers of the gates, there was a proper high place there with not one, but two horned altars. Well, so right around the time of Hezekiah, the horns were knocked off of the altars, and then the people who did it, they took an extra step, and they actually installed a toilet in this space. And so whenever you think about the temple and you think about the worship of God, one thing that's important to remember is that purity and impurity cannot coexist. Holiness and unholiness cannot coexist. And so this symbolic gesture of installing a toilet inside of a high place is really the ultimate way of taking something down. Archaeologists have found that actually it doesn't seem like the toilet was ever used by anyone, so it really was just a symbolic gesture that happened there. But it just sort of a curiosity and really an interesting find for the archaeologists who worked at Tel Lachish. I'm actually linking in the show notes to a news article about that so that you can see photographs of what they found there and read what the archaeologists have to say about this really interesting little shrine that they found inside the city gate at Lachish. So while the Bible, and specifically the Book of Chronicles, is most concerned with Hezekiah's piety and the big changes that he made to the worship institutions in the Southern Kingdom for Greater Israel, because of archaeology and because of the narrative that's in the Book of Kings, we actually know more about his political and his military, his war efforts at the time. He did a lot of building. Well, so about halfway through Hezekiah's reign, he ends up facing his own Neo-Assyrian king. It's a man named Sennacherib. So when Sennacherib came to the throne of Neo-Assyria, one of the first things that he did was move the capital city again. We talked last time about how it was in Nimrud, not far from Mosul. Well, this time he actually builds a new city at Nineveh, which actually is like right on top of modern day Mosul. And this particular area, archaeologists have found that people settled there as early as 3000 BC, but it definitely becomes most famous for being the biggest and most important capital of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Right there, Sennacherib, I mean, he built a massive city, and probably the biggest part of that was the palace that he built. It's called the Palace Without Rival, and it is on the southwestern portion of the city's citadel, and all of the building happened between 701 and 693. Well, if you take a look at everything that's there, that is an incredibly fast way to build such a massive and beautiful and adorned city. The walls of this palace were all carved with massive reliefs from Assyrian history and also with descriptions of the various campaigns that Sennacherib himself won over the years. And then also, as you walked into the palace and then throughout the palace, they would have these giant creatures that they call Lamassu. They are really similar to what the Bible would call cherubim. They resemble the Sphinx in Egypt. It's another one of these composite creatures that were designed to instill a feeling of fear and awe in any human who was walking into this space. In a palace, they were there to, in a way, guard the king, but more than anything, to help people understand that they were approaching someone who saw himself as a god, and also was someone who, you know, was deserving of fear and awe and all of those things. There were many, many treasures that were found there. The initial excavations at Nineveh began in the 1840s, and because it was done by Europeans, a lot of the artifacts were moved into European museums for exhibition. This is good and this is bad. It's nice that you can go to museums throughout the world and see some of these artifacts as they are on loan from other places. This also kept these particular artifacts from being destroyed in the ways that the ones at Nimrud were. So the other great thing that the British Museum has done is they have created a virtual tour. And so if you're interested in seeing this, once again, I've linked it in the show notes, you can actually go in there and virtually walk through the halls of all of the Assyrian exhibit that they have there. You can zoom in, you can look at the panels, all the panels that adorned the walls of that great palace in Nineveh. Well, in 2 Kings 18, after a summary of Hezekiah's religious reforms, we read that Sennacherib attacked all of Judah's fortified cities, including that city of Lachish, that place where there was the altar inside the city wall. Lachish was the second most important city for the Southern Kingdom, mainly because of its proximity to Jerusalem. It was really close to it, and it is situated in between Jerusalem and Egypt. And so whenever Egyptian armies would come up, which that will happen under Josiah, whenever Egyptian armies would come up, Lachish would sort of be Jerusalem's first line of defense. They would encounter there first. And so Lachish, it was incredibly well fortified. That gate, I guess it had room for an altar in it because it had six chambers, in the way that Megiddo and Gezer and Solomon's great cities did. It had 6 meter thick walls that went all the way around it. It also had a glacis, and this is, it's an earthen rampart that would be built. So you'd have basically slopes of of soil that would come out from the walls and would be significantly wider at the base than the city itself. And so they were designed, glacis was intended so that an attacking army would not be able to dig underneath a wall and enter a city by going under a wall. It was intended to, and was effective at keeping that from happening. Lachish also had the added step of putting a moat around that glacis so that if people are inside Lachish, Lachish is being stormed by people. If anyone is still going to try to tunnel underneath the glacis and underneath the walls to get into the city, well, the dry moat would expose those individuals who were trying to do that and make it easy for people with arrows or whatever weapons they had within the city. They'd be able to attack the people who were trying to get into them. And so it was very, very well defended. Well, the Neo-Assyrian army was technologically superior when it came to war. And they end up doing even bigger and better than that glacis. And they built an earthen rampart that is 70 meters wide and 16 meters tall. And they did this. It's similar to a glacis. It's all of this dirt and rock that gets piled up against the wall so that then they can take their siege machines, these large rolling machines that had battering rams on them, and they could shoot the balls of fire, all of that kind of stuff. They are machines designed to take down fortifications. Well, so because of this rampart, they were able to take it up to the top, use those battering rams to break through the wall and actually enter into Lachish that way. If you get to visit Lachish, which also I always recommend, that siege ramp is actually still there. It is the oldest siege ramp that is known to still exist in the world and the only Neo-Assyrian siege ramp that we know of that still exists in the world. So Sennacherib was really proud of his siege of Lachish, and it is one of the events that he immortalized in those reliefs that he put on the walls of his palace. Those are some of the ones that are in the British Museum today. In those reliefs, Sennacherib said that he took 46 cities and then that he besieged Jerusalem until it became a vassal. So Sennacherib really in his annals agrees with what the Bible says, and that is that he went after Jerusalem, but he did not conquer it at that time. Instead, Jerusalem sat back and agreed, you know what, we're just going to pay you gobs of money to leave us alone, and we will continue to pay you gobs of money so that you continue to leave us alone. And that is described in 2 Kings 18, 14 through 16. Same story there. Although in Sennacherib's version, Hezekiah pays him significantly more than the Bible says. So, you know, I don't know. Is that the king of the Neo-Assyrians puffing himself up and exaggerating a little bit? Or is it the Bible going the other way and trying to say, you know, no, like it was manageable. It wasn't that bad. You know, I don't know. We have two different things there. But regardless, Jerusalem does end up becoming a vassal city to Sennacherib. And probably even more important than that, it is during this time that the southern kingdom really shrinks down to where it is only greater Jerusalem. Lachish falls to the Neo-Assyrians, and all of the other cities in the area do fall to the Neo-Assyrians at this point. So for Sennacherib, the southern kingdom was really just a bump on his road to Egypt. What the Neo-Assyrians had wanted to do for a long time was actually conquer Egypt and become the only empire in the area. And so the southern kingdom was basically just in the way. I think the attack happened in 701. I think it probably would have happened regardless, but we do read in the Bible that Hezekiah did the same thing that the northern king Hosea did to Shalmaneser V, and that is he refused to pay tribute and he attempted to make an alliance with an Egyptian king. These two things really just gave Sennacherib an excuse to come down and attack when he did. But at some point, he definitely would have come into the southern kingdom because really what he wanted was Egypt. In despite of this being a relatively small nation, Sennacherib seems to be really, really proud of his conquest here. So much so that in his annals, he created three identical prisms that actually tell the story. And those prisms are found today. One's at the British Museum, one is at the University of Chicago, and the other one is, as you might expect, in the Israel Museum. So while Hezekiah was unable to stop Sennacherib from taking most of the country from him, he did do a lot of significant and even famous building projects within Jerusalem. And those are described across 2 Kings, Isaiah, and 2 Chronicles. It is mentioned that he fortified Jerusalem's walls, which there seems to be evidence for that, but probably most famously, he figured out how to keep fresh running water going into Jerusalem in case of a siege. So in ancient warfare, anytime a siege was set, the first thing that the attackers would do would be attempt to cut off the people's access to food and water. Well, that makes sense for a city because you're living inside a walled space. Any animals that people had who would need to go out and graze, they would do that outside of the city walls during the day. And if water, typically water sources were outside of the city wall. So people would have to go out of the city to draw their water every day just for daily life. And so this was a cruel yet ingenious way of trying to take down a city, is to literally starve and thirst the population out of existence at that time. Well, so what Hezekiah did was first he dammed the waters that were around it, specifically the Gihon Spring. And that was outside of the city, but by damming it, that created some pools. And then he went and he had a subterranean channel cut, and it was 533 meters long, and it was chiseled by hand, by many, many hands, out of solid rock. So it is an area that you can visit today. You have to go to the City of David, and you can take a tour. The tour lasts about 90 minutes, and part of that is actually walking through Hezekiah's tunnel. To this day, it has the fresh, clean, it feels like it is clean. It has this fresh water that is still running through it. And I did this in August one year, and I have to say that the water was cold. It felt cold and crisp and brisk, and really all anybody wanted to do, I think, was probably just get down there and take a scoop, you know, out. But being the adult that I was, I didn't do that. But there were some families who were behind me as we were going through the tunnel, and it sounded like maybe one of the kids did exactly that. And it was really funny because the kid got some water, and the father just, you know, no, you can't do that. Don't do that. Stop. And his correction of the child just echoed around us and bounced off of these walls and this low ceiling and even the water below. And it was just a really genuine human moment. This child who probably didn't fully understand the historical importance of where he was, you know, simply just wanting to get his face wet in the water. It was so sweet and so fun. I don't know. It's just a positive memory of me walking through there. But as you are going through, you actually come across an area where there is a duplicate plaque on the wall, and it details that is the location where the workers met. And so when Hezekiah commissioned this tunnel, he had people starting at different ends and working toward each other. So when you're in there, you can actually see the tool marks on the walls to this day. And then there's this inscription in the middle that explains how these two groups met together. One started at the north, one started at the south. And, you know, boom, they met in the middle. If you are not adventurous, if maybe you just don't like water, you just don't feel like getting your feet wet, or maybe you go a different time of year and the idea of cold water on your feet is not appealing, then you also have the option, if you do the tour of the City of David, of going through the Canaanite Tunnel, which is, it is higher, it is drier, there's no water that runs through it, and it is significantly older. So that is another option you could have. So you can still have the experience of walking through tunnels, but you can avoid the wet if you really do want to do that. So through all of his fortification projects and, of course, the work that he did in the temple, Hezekiah revealed himself to be a pretty wise king, one that we can look back on and look up to. But at the end of his life, he did something that maybe wasn't quite so smart. We get a story that at the end of his life, he is actually ill, and some people from the city of Babylon come and visit him. And while they are there, Hezekiah goes and he gives them a tour of the city and actually of his treasury. He shows everything that is there. And so in essence, what he does is give the people from Babylon a reason to come back in the future. It's not clear as to why Hezekiah did this, why he would show foreigners his country's treasure, but he did do that. It's possible that he was just trying to be a good diplomat. Some friends had come and he was just giving him a tour, or maybe it was a rare and really unprecedented in his life. Maybe it was a rare show of hubris. We don't know why he did it, but the result is the people who lived in Babylon, which Babylon was itself a city that was part of the Neo-Assyrian Empire at this time. That's actually going to change next week when we get to our next king, Manasseh. But Babylon, of course, will end up becoming the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And so he honestly gave these guys a preview of Jerusalem and let them know what all was in there. And this, from a literary standpoint, is foreshadowing for what is to come. And it's really just, it's a sad way for Hezekiah's life to end, with him, you know, giving a little glimpse into the glories of Jerusalem to the very ancestors of the people who would come and take it in 580. Join me next week when we learn about Hezekiah's successor and son, Manasseh. This wicked leader of the southern kingdom ascended the throne at age 12 and became the longest reigning monarch in ancient Israel, in spite of his work to reverse his father's religious reforms. The Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast is researched, written, and recorded by me, Amanda Hope Haley. It is edited by Tanya Yurimkiv. New episodes are released each Thursday. To interact with me and other listeners, make sure you click the follow button on the Red-Haired Archaeologist pages on Facebook and Instagram, and then subscribe to my channel on YouTube. Then check out my website at redhairedarchaeologist.com, where you can subscribe to my monthly email, order signed copies of all my books, and schedule me to come speak in your town.